us the part about Wilde being Matthew's godfather, which meant somehow he knew the history. More to the point, you're a trespasser who illegally scaled our security fence. They all took a step closer. Wilde stared straight ahead at the leader, but using his peripheral vision, he could see Thor sidle a little closer, hunching down like he was some sort of invisible ninja. Wilde didn't shift his eyes. Greyhair said, "We would be within our rights to meet your threat with physical force." So they were there now, all of them, standing on the same narrow precipice of which so many men over the entire course of human history had slipped and then plunged into bloody violence. Wilde still didn't believe that they would go there, that they would risk a big incident which might make the news or social media and awaken whatever controversy had finally quieted down. But you never know. That was the thing with the precipice. It was slippery. The best-laid plans do indeed go awry. Man may be evil or good. That wasn't the issue. The issue was that man rarely considered the consequences of his actions. In short, man was often just plain stupid. That was when it all changed. At first, the change was noticed only by Wilde. For scant seconds, the knowledge was his and his alone. 2 seconds, maybe 3, no more. Then, he knew, this advantage, and the change would be, he hoped, an advantage, would be null and void. Wilde felt what he had come to know as the disturbance. There were those who called it an omen, or a harbinger, or a premonition, something that gave his already heightened capabilities a supernatural undertone. But that wasn't it, not really. Over the millenniums, man has adapted both for better and worse. A recent example, navigation GPS. Studies show that parts of our brain, the hippocampus, the region used for navigation, and the prefrontal cortex, associated with planning, are already changing, perhaps even atrophying, because we now rely on GPS navigation. That's happened in a few years. But take the whole spectrum of mankind's history, how we sat in caves and forests, sleeping figuratively with one eye open, no protection, our primitive survival instinct in overdrive, and then think of how that has softened and eroded over the years with the advent of homes and locked doors and civilizations give and take. But Wilde didn't have that. From the time he could remember, Wilde grew up with those primitive impulses awakened. He understood before he could articulate it that a predator could attack at any time. He learned to sense it, to be attuned to any sort of disturbance. You still see this in nature, of course, in animals with supersensitive hearing or smell or sight, who flee before the danger gets too close. Wilde had this ability, too. So he'd heard the sound. No one else had. Yet. It was just a rustling. That was all. But someone was running toward them. More than one, probably. Someone was in danger and sprinting fast. Someone else was giving chase. Without so much as glancing away from Greyhair, Wilde glided a little closer to Thor. He wanted to be as close to the armored man as possible. A second later, no more, Wilde heard the scream, "Help! Matthew." This was where Wilde had to fight off his instincts and let his training take over. Instinct told him to run toward his godson's cry. That would be the natural reaction. But Wilde had braced for this moment. The scream, coming from behind Greyhair and up the hill toward the house, made all heads turn. That, too, was natural and expected. If you hadn't known that the scream was a possibility, you couldn't help but react. Thor looked in the direction of Matthew's scream, too, and away from Wilde. That was all the opening Wilde needed. The rest took a second, no more. Spinning with his left elbow at the ready, Wilde struck Thor in the side of his head. At the same time, before Thor could stumble back, Wilde's right hand dove into the opening of the jacket. His fingers found the butt of the gun in the holster under Thor's arm. By the time Matthew yelled help for a second time, Thor was on the ground and Wilde had the gun up and aimed, moving the muzzle between Gray Hair and the other two men. Wilde said, "Breathe wrong and I'll shoot you dead." From the ground, Thor groaned and lunged toward him. Wilde kicked him in the head. The slapping of feet on driveway drew closer. For a second, they all waited. Matthew turned the corner, sprinting seemingly for his life, two other boys not far behind him. Matthew pulled up, a look of confusion crossing his face. The two other boys did the same. "Go through the gate," Wilde told Matthew. "Get in the car." "But do it." One of the boys said, "We were just playing is all. Tell him, Matthew. Tell him we were just playing." Keeping his hands in the air, Gray Hair slid in front of the boy, speaking, "Stay behind me, Crash."
"It's just a game," Crash said.
"A game," Wilde repeated.
"Yeah, it's called Midnight Skull."
He pointed to the Smile Skull ring on his hand.
"It's like night tag. Tell him, Matthew."
Matthew didn't move. His eyes were glassy with near tears. In the distance, Wilde heard a car engine start. Reinforcements.
"Matthew, car, now!"
Matthew snapped out of it and hurried toward the gate. Walking backwards so as to keep the gun aimed at them, Wilde did the same. He kept his eyes on Gray Hair. He was the leader. The others wouldn't make a move without him. Gray Hair nodded, as if to say, "It's okay. Get out of here. We won't stop you." 10 seconds later, Wilde sped away with Matthew in the seat next to him. Chapter 9. Hester was back in her limo when she saw the calls coming in. She'd expected that. You can't just drop a bomb like this one about a missing girl and not expect something to explode. It was, in fact, her hope that someone would come forward or act or make a mistake or do something so that they'd know what really happened. Right now, when you added all the pros and cons, the options and possibilities, Hester figured that the girl had run off and was perhaps contemplating suicide. Not to be too cold and analytical, but if the awful task were already completed, well, there was nothing anyone could do. But if Naomi had taken pills, for example, or slit her wrists, or maybe she was just off someplace, standing on the edge of a high-rise or bridge, then this was the best chance to save her. Then again, because you have to see every side, maybe Hester's pushing would do the opposite. Maybe it would make the girl panic and act, or if she were being held, maybe it would make the kidnappers react with violence. Hester understood the risks, but she was not a woman who took stock in inaction. The first call she took had a caller ID that read, "Chief Westville Police." That would be Orin, she thought.
"That was fast," Hester said.
"Huh?
I mean, I'm flattered, Orin, but next time, wait a few days. It makes you look a little desperate."
I am a little desperate. What the hell was that report, Hester?"
"You saw it. Thanks for being a fan."
"Do I sound like I'm in the mood?"
"Something isn't right with Naomi's disappearance," Hester said.
"Then you should come to me."
"I did, remember.
I do. So what changed?"
"Her father said Naomi was with the mother. The mother said she's not with her. Her teacher..."
"Wait. You talked to her teacher?"
"Art teacher or guidance counselor or something. I don't remember. Ava something."
"When did you have the time to talk to her?"
This part would not go so smoothly.
"I didn't. Wilde did."
Silence.
"Orin, Wilde? You got Wilde involved in this?
Look, Orin, I probably should have given you a heads up before I went on the air.
Probably.
But I have a really bad feeling. You need to put some resources into this."
Silence.
"Orin, Matthew put you onto this," Orin said.
"Why?"
Now it was her turn to be silent.
"Whatever your grandson is hiding, he has to come clean now. You know this."
As they sped off from Maynard Manor, Wilde asked, "What happened?"
"It's like Crash said,"
Matthew said through a wince. He was still trying to catch his breath.
"We were playing a game."
You're going to lie to me now?
Matthew blinked back the tears.
You can't tell Mom.
I'm not going to.
Good.
Because you are.
No way! I'll tell you, but we can't tell her.
Sorry, it isn't going to work that way.
Then I'm not telling you a thing.
Yeah, Matthew, you are. You're going to tell me what happened. And then you're going to tell your mother. He hung his head.
Matthew, okay.
So what happened?
Did you know what Nana was going to do?
Do?
She went on the air about Naomi. She told everyone she's missing.
Wilde had wondered whether that was going to be her next move. Hester had been worried about leads drying up. What better way to beat the brush?
What did she say?
I didn't really hear it, Matthew said.
But Crash and Kyle and the others did.
And they got upset? Matthew started blinking.
Matthew? Crash kneed me in the balls.
More tears came to Matthew's eyes. A few spilled out. Wilde felt his hands tighten on the steering wheel.
They wanted to know what I told her. I rolled away. When I saw an opening, I ran.
You're okay now?
Yeah.
You want me to take you to a doctor?
No. I'll be a little sore, I guess.
Most likely. Does Crash have something to do with Naomi?
I don't know. It's...
It's what?
You can't tell anyone, okay? About Naomi. About tonight.
We've already been through this, Matthew.
I'll figure out how to tell Mom, but tomorrow, okay? Tonight, I don't want to say anything.
As he turned onto Matthew's street, he heard the whoop of a siren and the blue squad car lights came on. A voice over the loudspeaker said, "Pull over immediately." They were right down the street from the house, no more than 200 yards, so Wilde signaled out the window that he was going to cruise up to it. The car hit the siren again and spun right alongside them. The familiar voice over the loudspeaker, they both knew Orrin Carmichael, said in a tone that left no room for argument, "Immediately." To Wilde's surprise, Orrin cut them off with his squad car, forcing them to the curb. Orrin opened his car door and made his way toward them. By the time he arrived, Wilde had the window down.
"What the hell, Orrin? You know we live right down the block."
Orrin arched an eyebrow.
"We?"
"Mistake," Wilde thought. "I meant Matthew, this car.
You know what I mean."
Orrin looked inside the car. He nodded at Matthew. Matthew said,
"Hey, Chief."
"Where you coming from, son?"
Wilde said, "Maynard Manor."
"Why were you there?"
"Why would you care?" Wilde countered.
Orrin ignored him. "Son, I was at a party," Matthew said.
Orrin took a longer look at Matthew now.
"You don't look so good, Matthew."
"I'm fine."
"You sure?"
Wilde wasn't sure why they should tell Orrin about the incident in the house or not. Before he had a chance to say anything, Matthew said,
"I'm fine, Coach. We were playing Midnight Skull."
"What?
It's like tag or something, running around outside. That's why I look like this."
Orrin Carmichael frowned. He glanced at Wilde. Wilde gave him nothing. Then Orrin said,
"Why did you ask your grandmother to look for Naomi Pine?"
Ah, Wilde thought. So that explained the sudden stop. Orrin wanted to corner Matthew alone, away from both his mother and grandmother, two renowned attorneys, so he could get less evasive responses. Wilde said, "Don't answer." Orrin didn't like that.
"What?"
"I'm telling him not to answer."
"You don't have any legal standing here, Wilde."
"Yeah. I've been hearing that a lot tonight, but I'm not letting you question him without his mother present."
"I don't know where Naomi is," Matthew blurted out. "That's the truth."
"So why did you ask your grandmother to find her?"
"I'm just worried about her, okay?
She hasn't been in school and..."
"And?"
Wilde said, "Matthew, not another word."
"And kids pick on her is all."
"Are you one of those kids, Matthew?"
Wilde put his hand up.
"Okay, that's it. This conversation is over."
"Like hell." Wilde restarted the car.
"Turn that engine off right now," Orrin snapped.
"You charging us with something?"
"No."
"Then we are on our way. You can follow us to Matthew's house if you like."
But Orrin didn't follow them. As Wilde pulled the car into Layla's driveway, the front door opened. It was dark now, but with the light behind her, Wilde could make out Layla's silhouette standing in the doorway. She held her hand up high and awkwardly waved. When Wilde and Matthew got closer,
He could see that she was holding her mobile phone. "There's a call for you," she said to Wilde. Then she added, "On my phone." He nodded, and she handed it to him. He put the phone to his ear.
"We good?"
It was gray hair. Wilde wasn't surprised. They would have seen the license plate. Guys with his kind of juice would have no trouble getting a registration, a name, an address, phone numbers, both home and mobile. Layla was the car's owner. That would be the number they'd try.
"I guess," Wilde said. "Crash may have acted inappropriately."
"Uh-huh.
But the boy is under a lot of pressure. We hope you'll understand."
"There's a missing girl," Wilde said.
"Well, he doesn't know anything about her."
"So why is he under a lot of pressure?"
"Other things."
"Can I ask your name?" Wilde said.
"Why?"
"Because you know mine." There was a pause.
"Gavin Chambers."
"As in Chambers Security? As in Colonel Chambers?"
"Retired Colonel, yes."
Whoa, Wilde thought. The Maynards were not messing around when it came to security. He was tempted to move away so Layla wouldn't hear, but from the look on her face, that would only get him in hot water. "Do you know what Crash did to Matthew, Colonel?" Layla's eyes widened when she heard that.
"We have CCTV in the basement area," Gavin replied.
"So you saw it?"
"I did. Sadly, that particular footage no longer exists. Accidental deletion. You know how that is."
"I do."
"Will you accept our apologies?"
"I wasn't the one assaulted."
"Will you please pass them to young Matthew, then?"
Wilde said nothing.
"It's my job to keep the Maynards safe, Mr. Wilde. There's much more at stake here than a teenage brawl."
"Like what?" But Chambers didn't answer.
"I know you're good at what you do, but I'm good too, and I have vast resources. If there is conflict between us, it probably won't end well. There will be collateral damage. I make myself clear?"
Wilde looked at Layla and Matthew. The collateral damage. "I'm not a big fan of threats, Colonel."
"Neither of us wants to spend our lives looking over our shoulders, correct?"
"Correct."
"That's why I'm extending a hand of friendship."
"Friendship seems a bit strong."
"I agree. More like, to quote the French, détente. You can keep the gun, by the way. We have plenty of others."
"Good night, Mr. Wilde." He hung up. Layla said, "What the hell was that?" Wilde handed her phone back. His mind was working overtime. The immediate threat, the one he'd worried most about, was that Maynard's guys would come after them. That threat seemed to be neutralized for now. Matthew was home. He was safe. So now Wilde turned his attention back to Naomi Pine. The father had told Hester that Naomi was with the mother. That was a lie. It seemed obvious that Naomi's father was thus the place to start. Layla asked, "Did that call have something to do with Naomi Pine?" Matthew let out a small groan. "You know about that? Everyone knows about that. After your grandmother's report, the school sent out an emergency text. All the parent boards on social media are lighting up. Do you want to tell me what's going on, please?"
"Matthew will," Wilde said, tossing her the car keys.
"I have to go." "Wait, go where?" It would take too long to explain. "I'll try to come back, if that's okay." "Wilde." "Matthew will explain." He turned and ran toward the woods. Chapter 10. There is a theory, introduced by psychologist Anders Ericsson and made popular by Malcolm Gladwell, that 10,000 hours of practice makes you an expert in a given field. Wilde didn't buy it, though he understood the appeal in the simplicity of such encouraging pop slogans. He sped now through the woods, his eyes already accustomed to the dark. Theories like Erickson's didn't take into account intensity and immersion. Wilde had run through woods like these since before he could remember, alone, adapting, surviving. It wasn't practice. It was life. It was ingrained. It was survival. Yes, the hours mattered, but intensity matters more. Imagine if you have no choice. If you hike through the forest for fun, or because your dad likes it. It isn't the same as being forcibly immersed, of knowing the woods well or dying. You can't fake that. A man does an experiment, tries to see what it's like to be blind, so he covers his eyes. No, sorry, that isn't the same thing as being blind. You can always take the blindfold off. It's voluntary and controlled and safe. Some coaches tell kids to play like their life depends on it. That's probably sound motivational advice, but if your life doesn't depend on it, and it doesn't, the intensity will pale compared to the real thing. The best athletes? It is life and death in their minds. Now imagine how much better they'd be if the stakes were really that high. That was Wild in the woods. As he got closer to the Pine residence, he spotted a squad car and three news vans from local stations. The scene wasn't frantic. This wasn't the biggest story of the year or anything like that. But the news van had obviously heard Hester's report, and the cops had, in turn, asked them to move down the block away from the house. Wild spotted Orrin Carmichael by the Pine's front door, talking to a guy who had to be the father, Bernard Pine. The father seemed upset, not about a missing daughter, but about the police and media intrusion. He gestured wildly while Carmichael kept showing him his palms to calm him down. Wild's phone double-buzzed, indicating an incoming text. He checked and saw it was from Ava O'Brien. "Did you find Naomi?" He was tempted not to reply, but that didn't feel right. Not yet. There was the moving dots pause. Then Ava wrote, "Come over tonight. I'll leave the door unlocked." More moving dots. "I miss you, Wild." He pocketed the phone without a reply. Ava would get the message, much as he hated to send it this way. Wild crept out of the woods. He kept low and headed toward the neighboring backyard. No one spotted him. He stayed down. Naomi's father finished whatever he had to say to Orrin and slammed the door. For several seconds, Orrin Carmichael didn't move, almost as if he expected the door to reopen. When it didn't, he turned away and headed for his car. Another cop, this one far younger, met him there. "Keep the press back," Carmichael said. "Yes, Chief." "Are we going in?" Orrin frowned. "Going in? You know, like doing a search of the house." "The father says she's safe." "But that reporter on TV..." "A TV report is not evidence," Orrin snapped. "Get the press out of here." "Yes, Chief." When the kid left, Wild saw no harm. He stood upright and approached the car. Because he'd had enough with itchy fingers, he called out as soon as he could possibly be seen. "Orrin?" Carmichael turned. When he saw who it was, he frowned. "Wild, what are you doing here?" "What did the father say about Naomi?" "Not your business, is it? You know he lied to Hester, right?" Orrin Carmichael sighed. "Why on earth did Hester involve you in this?" "The father told Hester that Naomi is with her mother." "And maybe she is. Is that what he told you just now?" "He said she's safe. He asked me to respect her privacy."
"And you're going to do that?"
"Neither parent has filed a missing person report."
"So?"
"So. It's almost midnight. You want me to kick his door down?"
"Naomi could be in danger."
"And what? You think the father killed her or something?" Wild didn't answer. "Exactly," Orrin said, clearly exhausted by it all. "This is a girl who has run away before. My guess? That's what this is."
"Maybe it's something worse."
Orrin slid into the driver's seat. "If that's true, we'll find that out too, eventually." He stared up from the squad car. "Go home, Wild." He drove off as Wild headed back to the woods. He stopped behind the first tree and slipped on a thin black mask that covered everything except his eyes. He kept it with him always. The world now had more CCTV cameras than people, or so it seemed. You never know. So Wild, who had a thing about privacy in this privacy-less world, always came prepared. When Orrin's squad car was out of sight, Wild circled back so that he was now behind the Pine house. There were lights on in the kitchen, one upstairs bedroom, and in the basement. As a child, He had broken into countless lake homes and summer cabins. He'd learned to silently case them, circle them, check the driveways and lights, see who, if anyone, was home. To break in, he'd search for unlocked doors or windows. You'd be surprised how often it was that simple. Then move on to other means. If the locks were too strong or the alarm system too complicated, young Wilde would search for another house. Most of the time, even as a child, he had known to leave no trace of his being there. If he slept in a bed, for example, he made sure that it was made the next morning. If he ate their food or needed supplies, he was careful not to consume or steal too much so that the owners wouldn't notice. Had someone taught him all this when he was too young to remember? Or was it instinctive? He didn't know. In the end, man is an animal. An animal does what it has to do to survive. It was probably that simple. The phone in his pocket buzzed. The phone was a personally designed burner. That was all he used, and never for more than a week or two. At night, he turned it off. He didn't keep it with him. He knew that, even when the phone was off, it was possible to trace, and usually left it buried in a steel box by the road. It was Hester.
Are you with Layla?
No.
Where are you, then?
Casing Naomi's house.
You have a plan?
I do.
Tell me.
You don't want to know, he said. Wilde hung up and moved closer to the house. Loads of homes now had motion detector lights that would snap on when you approach. If that were to be the case, Wilde would simply sprint back into the woods, no harm, no foul. But no lights came on. Good. He kept close to the house. The closer to the wall, the less chance of being seen. He checked the kitchen window. Bernard Pine, Naomi's father, sat at the table and played with his phone. He looked nervous. Wilde circled the perimeter and peered in through the first floor windows. No one else present. No other movement. Wilde bent down and checked the basement windows. The shades were drawn all the way, blackout shades, but Wilde still spotted the small sliver of light. Someone down there, maybe. He had little trouble climbing onto the second floor overhang. He worried about the structure, if it could hold his weight, but he decided to risk it. There was a light in a corridor that shone through what appeared to be the father's bedroom. He climbed toward the corner back window, cupped his hands against the glass, and looked into the room. A computer monitor displaying a Dancing Lines screensaver provided the only illumination. The walls were blank. There were no posters of teen heartthrobs or favorite rock groups or any of the expected teenage girl clichés, except, perhaps, the bed, which was low to the floor and blanketed with stuffed animals, dozens of them, maybe hundreds, in various sizes and colors, mostly bears, but there were giraffes and monkeys and penguins and elephants. It was hard to see how Naomi could fit in the bed with all of them. She must have just jumped in, like she was living inside one of those claw crane arcade games. Naomi was an only child, so Wilde was pretty sure that this was her bedroom. The window was locked with a vinyl lever sash lock with keeper. Routine security for a second floor room. Most burglars don't scale walls to reach second floors. Wilde was, of course, different. He reached into his wallet and plucked out a Lloyd, short for celluloid, card. Better than a credit card, more flexible. He slid the Lloyd between the two sash frames and moved the lever into the unlocked position. It was that simple. 5 seconds later, he was inside the room. So now what? Quick check of the closet revealed the following. A pink Fjallraven Kanken backpack on the top shelf. Clothes neatly hung, no bare hangers. Meaning, he wasn't sure. The backpack was empty. If she'd run away, wouldn't she have packed it? Wouldn't there be some signs of missing clothes? Nothing conclusive, but interesting. There was a time, Wilde imagined, where it would pay to check the desk drawers or perhaps look under the pillow or mattress for a diary. But nowadays most teens keep their secrets in their tech devices. The phone would be better to search, of course, the place we store our lives, and no, that wasn't a comment on today's youth. Adults, too. Mankind has surrendered any pretense of privacy to those devices for the sake of... hard to say what. Convenience, he guessed. Artificial connections, maybe, which might be better than no connection at all. But it was not for him. Then again, real connections didn't seem to be as big either. Had the police tried to ping Naomi's location via her phone? Maybe, probably. Either way, he texted Hester to give it a try. Naomi's desktop computer had been left running. He moved the mouse, afraid that there might be a password blocking access. There wasn't. He brought up her web browser. Naomi's email information, name, and password had been saved for easy access. She was Naomi Flava, which seemed sweet and a little sad. He clicked and got in right away. He almost rubbed his hands together, hoping that he had hit the mother lode. He hadn't. The emails couldn't have been more innocuous. Class assignments, college recruitment spams, coupons, and offers from the Gap and Target, and retailers unknown to Wilde with names like Forever 21 and PacSun. Kids today, he knew from his interactions with Matthew, text or use some sort of parent-proof app. They don't email. He stopped for a moment and listened. Nothing. No one coming up the stairs. He moved the mouse's cursor up to the top and hit the history button. He hoped that Naomi hadn't cleared her cache recently. She hadn't. There were searches on eBay for stuffed animals. There were links to forums and Reddits that talked about collecting stuffed animals. Wilde glanced behind him at the bed. The stuffed animals had been laid out with some care. Several animals stared back at him. He thought about that for a second, about this girl who had been bullied all her life, how she must have rushed home after school, fleeing the taunts and abuse, maybe leaping high onto her bed, escaping into this lonely, self-created menagerie. The thought flooded him with surprising rage. People had bullied this girl her whole life. If someone did more to her, if someone went the extra mile or forced her to do something desperate, he bottled it and turned back to the task at hand. He still had the mask on his face. If, by some chance, Bernard Pine were to come upstairs or spot him, unlikely, really, Wilde would blow past him and run away. There would be nothing to identify him. His height and build, 6 feet, 185, would give them nothing. Whoa. Pay dirt. Naomi had been researching her classmates. There were six, maybe seven of them, but two names stuck out right away. One was Matthew's. The other was Crash Maynard's. The searches on Matthew, as well as his other classmates, were surface and quick. Did this mean anything? Or did teens Google each other all the time? You meet someone, you search online about them? Of course, Naomi had known these kids forever. She had grown up with them, gone to school with them, been a victim of their taunts and blows. So why now? He skimmed down through the rest of her Google searches. Nothing much stood out, except for an odd two-word search followed by an odd three-word search. Challenge game. Challenge game missing. He focused on the added word. Missing. He clicked through the links. As he started reading, his heart sank. He was midway through the pages when he heard a noise that startled him. Footsteps. Not close, not coming up toward him. That was what was odd. There was only one person in the house, the father, Bernard Pine. He was in the kitchen. But these steps weren't coming from the kitchen. In fact, now that he thought about it, he had not heard a sound coming from downstairs the entire time he had been up here. The footsteps were faint. They were coming from inside the house. But Wilde closed down the browser and slipped across the room and into the corridor. He looked down the stairs. The footsteps were louder. Wilde could hear a voice now. Sounded like Bernard Pine. Who was he talking to? Wilde couldn't make out the words. He crept closer to the top of the stairs so he could hear better. The door beneath the stairs flew open. The basement door. Wilde jumped back. The voice was clear now, easy to understand.
It was the goddamn news. That woman was here, too. What do you mean, who? That lawyer from TV. The one who did the report.
Bernard Pine closed the basement door behind him.
The cops just came. Yes, the chief, Carmichael. He knocked on the door. They're probably still...
Wild had his back pressed against the wall, but he risked a look. Bernard Pine had his mobile phone in one hand. With the other, he pushed aside a curtain and looked out into his front yard.
I don't see them right now, no. But I can't... I mean, Carmichael might be right down the block watching. There were news vans here, too. We're probably being watched.
We, Wild thought. Unless Pine considered himself royalty, we meant more than one person. Except that Wild had cased the house. He had only spotted one person, Bernard Pine. If someone else was here, there was only one place that person could be, the basement.
Yeah, Larry, I know you told me not to do this, but I didn't think I had a choice. I don't want to get caught. That's the big thing now.
Pine hurried up toward the stairwell, where Wild stood on the landing. He was hustling now, jumping the steps two at a time. Relying on reflexes, Wild dove back into Naomi's bedroom and rolled toward a corner. Pine passed him on the landing without glancing into his daughter's room. The basement, Wild thought. He didn't wait long. The moment Pine was past the door and in his own bedroom, Wild came out. Moving on the balls of his feet, not the toes made noise. He padded down the steps. He spun to his right and came to the basement door. He tried the knob. It turned. He opened the basement door silently, stepped inside, closed it behind him. There was a faint light below him. Wild had two choices here. Choice one, tiptoe down the steps and sneak slowly toward whatever was to be found. Choice two, go for it. Wild went for choice two. He took off his mask and strolled down the cellar stairs. He didn't disguise it. He didn't hurry, nor did he dawdle. When Wild arrived at the bottom, he turned toward the light. Naomi opened her mouth. "Don't scream," Wild said to her. "I'm here to help you." Chapter 11. The basement had been finished on the cheap. The walls were faux wood made of some kind of vinyl, stuck up on the concrete with adhesive. The sofa was a hand-me-down convertible that was right now opened into a queen-sized bed. It was blanketed with stuffed animals. Naomi Pine sat on the sofa's armrest, her shoulders slumped, her eyes down, so that her hair hung in front of her face like a beaded curtain. She wasn't skinny, which in today's world was to say that she was probably overweight, but Wild didn't really know. She was neither pretty nor ugly, and while her looks should be irrelevant, they weren't, not in the real world, and especially not in the teen world. So he looked at her, at her whole being, and it stirred his heart. In truth, if he could be totally objective, and maybe it was the history of the situation talking, Naomi Pine looked, above all else, like an easy target. That was indeed the vibe. Some people look smart or dumb or strong or cruel or weak or brave or whatever. Naomi looked like she was always in mid-cringe, as though she were asking the world not to hit her, and that just made the world sneer in her face.
"I know you," Naomi said. "You're the boy from the woods."
Not exactly accurate, or maybe it was.
Your name is Wild, right?
Yes.
"You're our boogeyman, you know."
Wild said nothing.
"Like, parents tell little kids not to go in the woods because the wild man will grab them and eat them or something. And, like, when kids tell ghost stories or try to scare each other, you're kind of the star of the show."
"Terrific," Wild said. "Are you scared of me?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"I'm drawn to outcasts," she said. He tried to smile.
"Me too."
"You ever read To Kill a Mockingbird?" she asked him.
"Yes."
"You're like our Boo Radley."
"I guess that would make you Scout."
"You're right," Naomi said with a roll of her eyes, and his heart felt it again.
"Who's Larry? I heard your dad on the phone."
"He's my uncle. He lives in Chicago."
Naomi lowered her head.
"Are you going to tell?"
"No."
"So you'll just leave?"
"If you want." Wild moved closer to her and made his tone as gentle as he could. "The challenge," he said. Naomi looked up at him.
"How do you know about that?"
He'd seen it on her computer, but he'd also remembered reading about it a few years back. The article had called it the 48-hour challenge, though it was later dismissed as an urban legend. It was an online game of sorts, albeit a fairly awful one. Teens would vanish on purpose so that their parents would panic and think that their child had been kidnapped or worse. The longer you disappeared, the more points you'd accumulate.
"It doesn't matter," Wilde said. "You were playing it, right?"
I still don't understand. Why are you here?"
"I was looking for you."
"Why?"
"Someone was worried."
"Who?"
He hesitated. Then he figured why not. "Matthew Krimstein."
She may have smiled.
"Figures."
"Figures why?"
"He probably blames himself. Tell him he shouldn't."
"Okay."
"He just wants to fit in, too."
Wilde could hear movement from upstairs. Her dad, no doubt.
"What happened, Naomi?"
"Do you ever read self-help books?"
"No.
I do all the time. My life."
She stopped, blinked back tears, shook her head.
"Anyway,
they always talk about making small changes, the self-help books. I tried that. It doesn't work. Everyone still hates me. You know what that's like? Every day to feel your whole insides twist up because you're scared to go to school?"
"No," Wilde said.
"But it must suck."
She liked that answer.
"It does. Big time. But I don't want you to feel sorry for me, okay?"
"Okay."
"Promise?"
He crossed his heart with his right hand.
"Anyway," Naomi said, "I decided to go for it."
"Go for what?"
"Change."
Her face lit up.
"Total change. One big move, one big thing. So I could erase my past as a loser and start again. Do you get that?"
He said nothing.
"So, yeah, I took the challenge. I disappeared. At first, I hid in the woods."
She managed to smile.
"I wasn't scared of you at all."
He smiled back.
"I lasted 2 days.
Was it rough?"
"No. I liked it, actually, out there on my own. You get that, right?"
"I do."
"Heck, you probably get it better than anyone," she said. "It was like an escape or a reprieve. But my dad, look, he's not the most on the ball. What I am, okay, I mean, me being a loser..."
"You're not a loser." Naomi shot him a look that told him he was patronizing her, and she was disappointed by it. He held up his hands as though to say, "My bad."
"Anyway, it's not his fault, all this. But he doesn't make it better either, you know what I mean?"
"I think so."
"So I was gone 2 days, and he started texting. He was going to go to the police, which is part of the game, right? Also, I was worried he'd start drinking too much. Whatever. Anyway, I didn't want that, so I came home, even though I knew 48 hours wouldn't be enough. And I told my dad what I was doing."
Wilde heard the footsteps now. "He didn't turn, didn't worry. And your dad decided to help?"
"He got it right away. He thinks I'm a loser, too."
Naomi held up her hand.
"Don't say it."
"Okay."
"I just wanted to, you know, fit in. Impress them."
"By them, you mean Crash Maynard?"
"Crash, Kyle, Sutton, all of them."
Wilde wanted to launch into a little speech about how you shouldn't want to impress bullies, or how trying to fit in was always the wrong move, that you should stay true to yourself and stick to your principles and stand up to the abuse. But he was sure that Naomi had heard it all before, and he would again sound patronizing. Naomi knew all the angles here better than he ever could. She'd lived them every day. He hadn't. She hoped that this move, a challenge, would make her cooler, and who knows, maybe she was right. Maybe Crash and his cohorts would be impressed when she came back. Maybe it would change everything for her.
Who the hell was he to tell her it wouldn't work?
My dad had the idea. I could just hide down here. He'd just pretend to be worried.
But then the cops showed up for real.
Right. We didn't count on that. And he can't tell the truth. Imagine if that gets out, what he'd done, what I'd done. I mean, oh, I'd get demolished in school. So he's freaking out right about now.
The basement door opened. From the top of the stairs, Bernard Pine called down.
Naomi!
It's okay, Dad.
Who are you talking to, honey?
Naomi's smile was bright now.
A friend.
Wilde nodded. He wanted to ask whether there was anything he could do, but he already knew the answer. He headed toward the basement stairs. Bernard Pine's eyes widened when he came into view.
Who the—
I was just leaving, Wilde said.
How did you—
Naomi said, it's okay, Dad.
Wilde walked up the stairs. As he passed Bernard Pine, he stuck out his hand. Pine took it. Wilde handed him a card. No name, just a phone number. If I can help, Wilde said. Pine glanced toward the windows.
The police might see you.
But Wilde shook his head and started toward the back door. He had his mask in his hand now. They won't. 1 minute later, Wilde was back in the woods. As Wilde headed back toward Layla's, he called Hester.
Naomi is fine, he explained. When he finished, Hester shouted,
Are you shitting me?
This is good news, he said. She's safe.
Oh, great, fine. She's safe, la-di-da. But in case you missed it, I just went live on air saying a teenage girl went missing. Now you tell me she's hiding in her own basement? I'm going to look like a fool.
Ah, Wilde said.
Ah?
That's all I got, ah.
And all I got is my reputation. Well, that and my good looks.
It'll be okay, Hester. She sighed.
Yeah, I know. You going back to the house?
Yes.
So you'll tell Matthew?
I'll tell him enough of it.
And then you'll go to bed with Layla?
He didn't reply.
Sorry, she said.
Get some sleep, Hester.
You too, Wilde.
The next day, Naomi was back in school. She hoped no one would ask too many questions, but they did. Soon, her story collapsed, and the truth that she had cheated in the game of challenge came to light. If school life had been hell for Naomi before, this latest revelation raised that hell to the 10th power. A week later, Naomi Pine disappeared again. Everyone assumed that she'd run away. 4 days after that, a severed finger was found. Part 2. Chapter 12. 1 week later. A car pulled into his hidden road. Wilde knew that, because he'd laid down a rubber hose alarm, the kind you see every day at gas stations across this country, at the entranceway. Old school, but more effective in this setting. Animals set off motion detectors. They'd trip every hour with false alarms. Only something heavier, like cars, triggered the hose alarm. He'd just been staring at the small screen at the time, more specifically at an email from one of those ancestry sites with a subject that trumpeted, "We have your DNA results right here," when the notification about the intruder popped up. Wilde had been debating whether to click the link or let sleeping dogs lie, just as he'd debated whether to take the test at all, whether to begin this journey down a probably dark path in the first place. Submitting his DNA under a pseudonym, he'd concluded, was safe enough. He didn't have to look at the results. He could just let them sit there, behind that link. There were those who would wonder why Wilde had waited so long, why he hadn't already taken this obvious step. With companies like 23andMe and Ancestry.com advertising nonstop about how they'd helped reunite hundreds, if not thousands, of long-lost relatives, wouldn't it be natural for Wilde to send in his own swab and perhaps learn his own origin story? The extemporaneous, unthought-out answer was yes, of course, but when he took more time with it, when he contemplated the full ramifications, Wilde
wasn't so sure. Should Wild, a man who enjoyed living off the grid, a man who really couldn't connect to most people, open the door to meeting strangers who could claim him as blood and thrust themselves into his life? Did he want that? What possible good could come from learning about his past? The rubber hose alarm triggered the rest of Wild's more state-of-the-art system. Most times, especially a few years back, if a car pulled onto the road, it was by mistake, a wrong turn. Wild had, in fact, set up a clearing right past the road's entrance so as to make it easy for a car to realize its error, K-turn, and head back out. Now, though, with the overgrowth of vegetation in full effect, the turnoff wasn't really visible from the main road, so those accidental visitors were far rarer. Still, they happened, and that could be the case here. When the second and third motion detectors kicked in, it became clear that the car had no intention of turning around. That meant someone was looking for him. Wild lived in a customized spheroid-shaped pod called an eco-capsule. The eco-capsule was a micro-smart house or off-the-grid eco-abode or compact mobile home, whatever you wanted to call it, created by a Slovakian friend he met while serving in the Gulf. The structure resembled a giant dinosaur egg, though Wild, using five different matte colors, had painted it camouflage to keep it hidden from view. The total living space was small, under 70 square feet, one room, but it had all he needed, a kitchenette with a cooking plate and mini-fridge, a full bathroom with water-saving faucet and showerhead, and an incinerator toilet, which turned waste into ash. The furniture was built-ins, table, cabinets, storage, a folding bed that could be either a twin or double, all made from lightweight honeycomb panels with an ashwood veneer finish. The egg exterior was made from insulated fiberglass shells overlaid on a steel framework. The eco-capsule was, no reason to pretend otherwise, super cool. There were those who would assume from the dwelling that Wild must be an eco-nut or extremist. He wasn't. The capsule gave him privacy and protection. It was self-sustainable and thus totally off the grid. There were photovoltaic power cells on the roof and a pole with a wind turbine that could be mounted when he needed more battery charge. The spheroid shape made collecting rainwater easy, but if there was a dry spell, Wild could add water by any source, lake, stream, a hose, whatever. The water would then be cleaned via reverse osmosis water filters and UV LED lamp, making it instantly potable. The storage tank and water heater were adequate for one man, though Wild would confess to enjoying luxuriating under Layla's jet propulsion showerhead and seemingly limitless supply of hot water. There was no washer and dryer, no microwave, no television. He didn't really care. His electronic needs consisted of a laptop and phone, which were easy enough to power up in the capsule. There were no thermostats or light switches. All of those sorts of functions were performed via the smart home app. The pod was also easy to put on a trailer and move, something Wild did every few weeks or months, even if the move was only 50 or 100 yards. At this stage of the game, it was probably overkill to move that often. But when his home stayed in one place too long, it felt to him as though the pod, and thus he himself, were taking root. He didn't like that. Right now, Wild was standing outside the gullwing door, taunted by that DNA site link. The sensors and cameras, all set up to solar power cells, streamed digital videos to his smart device. He took a look as the car on the screen, a red Audi A6, came to a stop. The driver's door opened. A man half fell out and took some time to right himself. Wild recognized him. They had met only once. Bernard Pine, Naomi's dad.
Wild?
Wild heard him through the microphones in place. He was still too far away to hear him without that. He hurried down the familiar path toward the road. The hike was a little more than a quarter mile. He had a weapon in his pod, a standard military-issue Beretta M9, but he saw no reason to pack it. He didn't like guns and wasn't a good shot. The night at Maynard Manor, when he'd taken the gun off Thor, he'd been glad that he hadn't been required to fire it, not so much because he didn't want to hurt anyone, but because from that distance, Wild's marksmanship with a handgun
could kindly be described as suspect. Wilde silently came up behind Bernard Pine.
"What's up?"
Pine startled and spun toward him. Wilde wondered how he had learned about this spot, but it wasn't really that much of a secret. This was how you contacted Wilde. People knew that.
"I need your help," Pine said.
Wilde waited.
"She's missing again," Pine said. "Naomi, I mean. She didn't run away this time."
"Did you contact the police?"
"Yes."
"And?" He rolled his eyes.
"What do you think?"
"They thought, of course, that she ran away again. Her challenge game," Pine explained, "had been exposed as a hoax, which just fueled the school bullies. The taunts intensified. Naomi had grown even more despondent. For the police, there was also the boy, or in this case girl, who cried wolf aspect of the whole thing, too."
"I'll pay you," Pine said. "I've heard..." He stopped.
"Heard what?"
"That you do stuff like this? That you were a hotshot investigator or something?"
That, too, was an overstatement. He'd been the W in the security firm Craw, his specialty being overseas protection and defense. Because of his unusual status, and because no one could even find a birth certificate for him, he handled the most sensitive cases that required the greatest amount of secrecy. When he'd made enough money, he quit the daily routine but stayed on as a silent partner at Craw, officially retiring into that murky part of any business called consulting.
"She didn't run away," Pine repeated.
There was a slur in his speech. Pine had the whole after-work drinks thing going on, the bloodshot eyes, the wrinkled shirt, the loosened tie.
"Why do you say that?"
Pine mulled that over. Then he said,
"Would it sway you at all if I said a father just knows?"
"Not in the least."
"She was taken."
"By?"
"I have no idea."
"Any signs of foul play?"
"Foul play?" He frowned. "Are you for real?"
"Any evidence at all she was taken?"
"I have the absence of evidence."
"Meaning?"
Bernard Pine spread his hand and smiled in a creepy way.
"Well, she's not here, is she?"
"I don't think I can help you."
"Because I can't prove she was taken?"
Pine staggered toward Wilde a little too quickly, as though he was going to attack. Wilde took a step back. Pine stopped and held up his hand in surrender.
"Look, Wilde, or whatever the hell they call you, have it your way. Let's say Naomi ran away. If that's the case, well, she's out there all alone."
He lifted both arms and spun, as though to indicate his daughter might be in these specific woods.
"She's been traumatized by those Neanderthals in her school, and now she's scared and sad, and she needs to be found."
Tough for Wilde to admit, but that made sense.
"Will you help me?" "No, not me. Forget me. You met Naomi. I can tell you connected with her. Will you help Naomi?"
Wilde stuck his hand out. "Give me your car keys."
"What?"
"I'll drive you home. You can tell me everything you know on the way." Chapter 13 Hester tried to focus, but she also felt giddy as a schoolgirl. Her guest right now on Crimstein on Crime was famed activist attorney Saul Strauss. The topic, like the topic of nearly every broadcast on every show right now, was the disruptive presidential campaign of Rusty Eggers, a talk show guru with a sketchy background. But her mind, heading into commercial break, was on the text she'd just received from Orrin Carmichael.
"I know you're going on air. Can I come up and talk when you're done?"
She'd giddily, man, she was too old for all this giddy, replied yes, and that she'd leave Orrin's name at reception, and he could come up at any time. She almost typed one of those emoji hearts or smiley things at the end, but a fly-through of common sense restrained her. But still. Coming out of commercial, Hester read the quick bio on Saul Strauss off the teleprompter. Son of an old-school Republican governor from Vermont, served in the military, graduated from Brown University, taught at Columbia Law School,
worked tirelessly now as a staunch defender of the underserved, of the downtrodden, of green causes, for animal rights. In short, he never met a bleeding heart cause he didn't betroth with total ferocity.
"Just to be clear," Hester said, diving straight in, "you are suing the producers of the Rusty Show, but not Rusty Eggers himself, is that correct?"
Hester guessed that Saul Strauss was in his early 60s. He had the trappings of a stereotypical liberal arts professor, long gray hair and a ponytail down his back, flannel dress shirt under corduroy burnt orange sports coat, complete with the patches on the sleeves, facial hair that sat somewhere between fashionable and Amish, reading spectacles dangling from a chain around his neck. But no matter how he dressed, Hester could still spot the steeliness of the old Marine.
"Exactly. I represent one of the advertisers for the Rusty Show who was justifiably concerned that he was sold a false bill of goods."
"Which advertiser?"
Strauss's hands